Welcome to Grain on the Brain by the Prairie Organic Grain Initiative. We're working to create resiliency and stability in the prairie organic grain sector. Tune in each month as we're joined by an industry expert and farmer to discuss important issues in organic grain farming. Check out our website at pivotandgrow.com and see what organic grain production can do for you. We bring the resources, tools, and expertise you need to get growing.
All right. Hello, everyone. We're here with Catherine Stanley from the University of Manitoba Natural Systems Ag Lab. And we'd like to talk a bit today about planning a crop rotation for an organic cropping system. Catherine did her undergrad work at the University of Manitoba, finished a master's through the University of Saskatchewan, focusing on tillage options for weed management in organic cropping systems. And she currently is a bit of an extension person with the Natural Systems Ag Lab. So we're happy to have you here today. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So our topic for today has to do with planning a rotation. We'd like to get into a bit of the reasons why, I guess, it makes sense to have a crop rotation in an organic system.
Sure. I've been asked to talk today a little bit about different reasons to have a crop rotation, and then we'll probably get into some of the strategies for designing that crop rotation. But I think really what it comes down to is, you know, when you properly design a rotation for your farm system, you will really, in the long run, help yourself out by reducing pest pressures, reducing pressures from various types of weeds. I think one of the most important things for organic farmer is being aware of disease and disease cycles. So designing your rotation so you can avoid building up some various crop diseases and soil-borne diseases as well. And then beyond some of the things that directly maybe improve your bottom line or something you'll see in the yield, is that at the end of the day, a good crop rotation can help to improve the health of your agroecosystem and really will be economically viable and affect your economic bottom line in the long run.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think you touched on something to do with noticing whether the weeds that you're seeing, are they cool season weeds, warm season weeds, grasses or broadleaves, and maybe using that information to try and help you to decide how to deal with those things.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, even you touched on another important part, is that obviously different crops are more or less competitive with weeds, and, you know, rotating those crops through is another tool that you have in your pocket, and something that, you know, as far as a good solid green manure or a perennial phase of your rotation is a great thing you can do in your crop rotation to control weeds, whereas something like a pea or a pulse also has its role in a crop rotation, but as far as it goes for weed management, not as competitive with weeds, and you should be prepared to rely more on mechanical weed strategies for those types of crops.
Would you like to talk a little bit about some of the different green manure strategies?
Yes, sure. So I think one of the things that's really important, you know, and maybe I even should have started with this, but that the green manure really is, like, the basic role and function of the green manure is key to a good crop rotation. And I mean, beyond the weed management and also the diversification that a green manure brings, it really is the central part of your rotation that makes sure you're getting enough nitrogen into your system to carry on the other cash crops you're planning on growing. And maybe at this point too, there's been some discussion if you have access to consistent levels of manure, you know, is a green manure something that is still important in your rotation? And I think the simple answer is yes. You know, once you are importing manure, and obviously this depends on what type of brown manure you're importing, but typically you will run into an excess in phosphorus before you've supplemented all your nitrogen. So making sure that you're still incorporating a green manure in rotation, despite the addition of a potential source of livestock manure, is critical for that nitrogen without overloading your soil with phosphorus. So I think some of the research that the Natural Systems Agriculture Lab has done over the last few years has shown that having a legume-based green manure, so having at least over 50% of the plant material growing must be a nitrogen-fixing crop. Every 1 in 3 years has proven, this is in Carmen, to provide enough nitrogen to carry the remainder of your rotation. But that being said, if you are also using either late season green manures or cover crops, or diversifying with an understory cover crop through the season, there is room to move that to every 1 in 4 years. So there's a bit of flexibility in that as well.
Very good. I guess I wonder, right on the end there, you touched on some seeding a cover crop as an understory or as a bit of a relay crop. Can I get you to speak a bit about ways to add diversity just in little areas of the crop rotation that are kind of unused otherwise?
You bet. So I think incorporating cover crops and relay cropping, you can think of them to provide at least some of the same soil benefits that you'll get by having a green manure in rotation. So by having some more diversity beyond your cash crop, you will help to build up soils and build up soil organic matter. I would say that we've kind of gone through different years as far as moisture goes, but traditionally, including cover crops and green manures, by having something growing on the soil surface will help you conserve moisture and also control your erosion. But beyond the full year that you devote to your green manure, there's a lot of ways to diversify through either underseeding into a growing cash crop, something like a clover or another nitrogen-fixing plant species. I know quite a few farmers have been exploring ways to get that green manure established almost in the year before where you're going to be going or doing your termination method to get that nitrogen return. So potentially broadcasting and harrowing a small seeded clover into a growing wheat stand or something like that, where it's just hiding out there underneath the crop canopy. And really when it comes into being in full force is after crop harvest, when it has access to that light and it extends that period of time in your crop rotation where you have something green growing and something accessing nutrients and moisture in the soil. So like you said, it just helps to, I guess, expand your rotation, but also incorporate more diversity beyond just an annual seeded green manure every 1 out of 3 or 1 out of 4 years.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I guess the more we hear, the more we learn about soil health, it seems like having a green root growing, having something alive to support your soil life is pretty important. So I wonder if there's more you can say about the effects on soil health to do with including that green manure as well as trying to have something growing all the season long.
Yeah, so I think like as far as trying to have something growing as long as you can, there are pretty obvious, I mean, soil and biological benefits to having that. But as far as the basic principle of designing your crop rotation, if at, you know, the bare minimum you can focus on making sure you have a really good green manure, one of the things that we kind of touched on but didn't really dive into is having diversity within your green manure species and maybe not necessarily 5 or more, but having, if you're having at least 2 different kinds of legumes, you're relying on your legume to fix your nitrogen and you want to make sure that something succeeds. So having maybe two different legume species that respond differently to moisture. If you have only peas in your green manure and we have a very wet spring, likely those peas are not going to thrive and they're not going to be able to fix that nitrogen you need to carry the rest of your rotation. So I think once you can kind of understand your landscape and once you get a good grip on your soil, as well as the environmental fluxes, working to include cover crops, protect the soil, and have something growing as long as possible really will help to build up your soil organic matter. And if your cover crop of choice is a legume, it will fix more nitrogen. If you're growing a cover crop, it doesn't always need to be a legume. There are roles, for example, growing some fall rye, just as to hold your soil into the winter. There are a lot of farmers that really like that. There are a lot of organic farmers that like that because fall rye has allelopathic properties and exudes a chemical from its roots that will kill small weed seeds within the proximity of the plant. So there are also management benefits to include some of these cover crops.
Yeah, I just think it's important to try and keep something growing there. I guess I've seen a lot of us that have switched to organic cropping systems and gone away from more conventional systems are doing more tillage than we used to do. And in the last few years, there's been some pretty significant soil erosion events over the winter and into the spring. And so, yeah, having something that, even if it's not alive in the spring, will provide some good cover and still have a root that's kind of holding things down, I think is a really good idea to try and do as much as you can.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think one of the things that you touched on that also is important to crop rotation planning is having those phases of growing crop to respond to the fact that there is more tillage in an organic cropping system and to balance, you know, those tillage phases with soil building is really important. And having something growing as long as possible is definitely a way that can be achieved.
Do you see people moving towards more perennials in their rotation to act as that green manure? I guess when I look back historically in our area, we are and generally haven't been limited by moisture historically. And so a lot of the old timers in this area would have grown a sweet clover biennial cover crop and plowed it down the following spring prior to seeding their wheat crop. And part of me is looking towards using that, I guess, to accomplish a few goals. But the big one is to grow more nitrogen and to have that soil cover over the fall, winter, spring kind of months. And I'm wondering if you see more people looking towards that type of system.
Yeah, and I've seen a couple examples right across the prairies of situations where someone like yourself or a farmer obviously wants to figure out a way to incorporate perennials or bring animals onto the land, but really doesn't want to have the animals or to be responsible for the animals. And so there's been some collaborations, kind of you mentioned, where either working with a neighboring farmer or even beyond that, someone who wants to raise livestock and doesn't have land. So those are all kind of different innovations that people can think about to try to bulk up their rotation and to get perennials on the land and make it be economically feasible for themselves.
And I think trying to include grazing livestock is probably a really good key to being able to do that. We've tried red clover and a mix of other clovers underseeded into our cereals and then tried to keep them for a year after. And we've been mowing them once or twice in the summer to manage them and manage any weed seed set that's inevitably going to come up with them. But we burned a lot of fuel and we spent a lot of time doing it.
You know, I think when we talk about all the different principles and best management practices of a crop rotation, you know, one of the things that I try to remind myself especially when I'm working with farmers, is that, you know, beyond the agronomic and environmental considerations of your crop rotation, it's really important to make sure that a crop rotation works for that farmer and works for the farm. And in general, like, there is kind of a small little formula that you can follow, but the crops you choose not only need to make agronomic sense, but need to also work for the farm and the farmer. And so some of the things that come into play include, you know, equipment and labor availability. Scott, you were talking a little bit about, you know, needing to mow your grain manures. And so, you know, when you're mowing your grain manures, are there other things on the farm that need to be done? Are there weed control passes that need to be done in certain crops? So balancing your rotation to make sure that you don't need all of your equipment at the same time, or that you don't need, you know, you don't have more operations in the field than you have people working on your farm. So thinking about some of those things, you know, being conscientious about where are your field locations, and what are some of the other things you're trying to manage on your farm. Perhaps you have other landscape factors like shelter belts, you know, various water management strategies as well. But one of the, you know, I think when you're choosing crops and when you're incorporating all these various principles, it's just important to reflect on yourself as a farmer and also what type of rotational, well, how the rotation fits into the lifestyle you want to have on your farm. And I had mentioned to you before, Scott, that I was working with a farmer that, you know, really wanted to focus their rotation on winter cereals and, you know, understood the agronomic benefits of having winter cereals, but also, like, wanted to have some time to take some holidays in the summer. And I think that's perfect. I think that's, you know, all of those things are important to consider and to incorporate into your farm plan.
Visit pivotandgrow.com and check out our production fact sheets. Get practical information to integrate into your farming systems to improve your marketing and production practices. Learn how to design an optimal rotation plan, live with weeds, increase crop diversity, and so much more.
So I think after the green manure year, you know, if you're thinking about planning what type of crops you're going to include into your next green manure, one of the, you know, important things is you're hopefully going to have a lot of available nitrogen in that first year. So choosing a crop that is a heavy nitrogen feeder or requiring a lot of nitrogen in year one is probably your best bet. And ideally that crop should also be able, like, be marketable and be a good economic choice for you. So something like, one of the things that we see pretty regularly would be something like a spring wheat, where you need that high protein, you need the nitrogen to get that high protein percent to go up into a higher market grade. So that's just one example. One that we've seen over the last 5 years move more onto the prairies is something like hemp. So hemp requires a lot of nitrogen. So putting hemp after good green manure would also be something that's important to consider. And then kind of as you go, you want to balance those heavy nitrogen requiring crops with crops that don't need too much nitrogen. So perhaps you want to grow a legume, a grain legume, after your first crop, after your heavy nitrogen requiring crop, so after your green manure. And then it's important to, so like alternating nitrogen fixers basically with crops requiring nitrogen. And then once you kind of are at a point, perhaps in the year before you plant a green manure again, when your soils are getting a little bit lower in your nutrients, are to grow lighter feeders. So something like flax or oats. And I mean, oats and in particular are a great scavenger and are actually a crop that you wouldn't want to put on a heavy nitrogen soil because they have other agronomic things that affect them, like lodging. So they are a good crop to kind of tie up your rotation with together. And so in general, those are some of the things you need to think about. Balance from the economic side, you want to make sure that you have a diversity in crops that are that have different economic values. You want to balance those cash crops with your soil building crops, and really try to design those other crops within the rotation in a way that you can build resilience in your crop rotation to various fluctuations in both the environment and in the economy. Also, one of the things that's important to consider or to think about is whether or not your crop type is mycorrhizal. And mycorrhizal crops, they build associations with arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi in the soil, and they are better able to extract certain nutrients. So say you're trying to build up your soil in phosphorus and you're quite low, growing some of these mycorrhizal crop species will help to make that crop be successful in that low phosphorus environment. Also taking into consideration in your rotation, crops like mustard that are non-mycorrhizal will not build those associations in the soil. So in your rotation, to consider whether or not you want that crop to have those established association is important if you're hoping that your crop's going to take advantage of some of the phosphorus that might not be able to otherwise gain access to.
Very good. Would you want to speak to the value of an intercrop? I think we kind of covered it to some extent within the green manure year, but as a cash crop, are you seeing more adoption of people growing peas and oats or peas and mustard or things like that together?
I feel like there is a lot of potential for growing intercrops in your rotation. Like you said, we touched on it a bit in a green manure. It's a way to, you know, diversify within a year. Sometimes in, you know, when we're in class, we say like diversify in space, not only just in time. And I think intercrops are a really great way to, they're a great risk management tool. And they're something we're still learning a lot about. In a green manure, they require a little less fine tuning because you're just kind of shooting for an average over 50% of that legume. But when we are moving into a grain system where more often than not, one of your grain species is your targeted cash crop, to figure out and to play around a little bit with seeding rates and things like that can be a bit more challenging. And I think we're starting to learn a lot more about intercrops and the best ways to manage them. But you mentioned peas and oats and peas and mustard. I think those are two really great classic examples. They are perfect examples for Manitoba and I'm sure other parts of the prairies where, you know, a crop like peas, where there's a good economic value to them, there's a growing market for peas. You know, we have a lot of disease in the soil that makes it very challenging to grow peas. Peas are also kind of a baby. If there's too much moisture in the soil or even just slightly too much moisture in the soil, those peas will just not perform and you likely won't get as high of a yield on that crop. So in theoretical terms, they're a very risky crop to grow. But a lot of the research that's been done by Lana Shaw and Scott Chalmers has shown just immense benefits, mostly to risk management of growing, you know, your peas with a mustard or an oat where you maybe weren't going to get that yield if something slightly in an environmental condition was a little bit off. There's possibility over your whole landscape for those two crops to kind of ebb and flow and fill those niche spaces and make sure that there's something, like you said before, growing at all times. And you're kind of hedging your bets and making sure that you're going to be harvesting something off that field.
What do you see as the role of crop rotation in dealing with disease?
I think, you know, as far as disease management, there are certain diseases that really take off in certain crop types. And it kind of is as simple as not growing the same crop type year after year. So, for example, growing two cereals in a row, you might be increasing different spores of rust or fusarium, for example. So if you've had issues with fusarium, understanding what crops in your rotation are susceptible to fusarium and not having too many of those throughout your entire rotation. Another one would be ephenomyces, which is a soil-borne disease, or ascochyta, which is more prevalent in pulse crops. So if you have peas and lentils in your rotation, you know, those two crops are susceptible to the same type of diseases and, you know, are a host for various soil and above ground diseases. And to be aware of not having, you know, multiple pulse crops as grain crops, or for that matter, in your green manure, to spread them out over your rotation so that you're not building the disease in the soil or above the ground, just as a couple examples. So even to consider to know and do a little bit of reading, certain things that peas are susceptible to, faba beans are not. So perhaps if you are thinking about starting to grow peas as a cash crop in your rotation, substituting out a pea in your green manure with a faba bean or a clover or something else that will fix nitrogen that doesn't have susceptibility to the same disease profiles is really important.
And I think a lot of the same rules apply for dealing with insects. I guess just getting away from seeing the same types of crops back to back in rotations can do a lot to deal with in managing insect pressures. During the green manure phase of our rotation, we have to make a decision. How long can we go before the next green manure? And I guess, are there any tools that help to make those decisions and to help you assess how the green manure did or is doing?
Yeah, actually, so Joanne Thiessen-Martens, who was also a colleague of mine in the Natural Systems Agriculture Lab, created a green manure bioassay, which was built into kind of a larger nutrient budgeting tool, which really, I think, is an invaluable resource for organic farmers that helps to take a lot of the guesswork. I mean, we talked about a lot of the various principles, which are important, but I think to know exactly how much nitrogen you can account for, or not exactly because there are a lot of other environmental factors, but a ballpark of how much nitrogen you can account for from that green manure can help to take some of the guesswork out of your crop rotation planning. And so Joanne developed a protocol essentially for a green manure bioassay. And, you know, I'll keep it pretty simple, but the basic idea is that you would take a biomass sample, so a cutting of a known area in your green manure. So you could take a measuring tape out there and take a square meter or something like that. And then essentially you just send it in for feed analysis to a nutrient testing lab. And that will come back with all sorts of nutrient information, and what some of the important things are would be nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and sulfur. And not only can these tools tell you how much nitrogen you can expect to return into your soil, but they can give you a good indicator of where your phosphorus levels are at in your plant tissue, because nitrogen hopefully is not going to be a limiting resource in your green manure if you have enough legumes. It can be a good indication how that plant is able to take phosphorus out of the soil. And I think once you have, as far as crop rotation planning goes, once you have a general idea of how much nitrogen you're returning into the soil, you can use it kind of like a bank. And so you have your initial investment, and you can, even if you wanted to guess based on what your crop yields are or your average crop yields, you can look at what the nutrient value is of that grain. And it's essentially just, it is a budget. You have things going into your bank and things coming out of it. And ultimately, by the end of your rotation, depending on the goals of your rotation, if you want to build nutrients, you want to be on the positive. And if you are just hoping to stay in a stable state, you want to be around that zero. So net neutral. But so that bioassay, you know, is not only just a good tool for nitrogen, but it's a great tool to give you an idea of where some of your other nutrients, especially phosphorus, are performing.
Yeah, and I think it's a good way to give a measure of how how accessible that phosphorus is, because what you're looking at is what the plant's been able to take up, right? Whereas when we're looking at a soil test, it's often more like what's there, and it's there's a little bit of guesswork involved in deciding how much we can actually access and how much we are actually accessing. So I think it's a good way to kind of look at that level over time and see if it's going up or down or what's happening. And I think for nutrients like phosphorus, that's a good way to look at it.
I think that's, you know, a really critical point. And I think, I know it was part of the inspiration for Joanne to look at this bioassay because she had been working on a lot of organic farms across the prairies and you know, it was finding a whole range of plant performance under various levels of soil test phosphorus. And so that's why Joanne started to look at the bioassay. And like you said, to look at the plant extractable level of phosphorus and what that green manure is actually using. And, you know, I think we didn't talk too much about phosphorus as it's a, you know, a whole other topic, but, you know, making sure that especially your green manure can access that phosphorus because it requires, you know, a reasonable level of phosphorus to fix the nitrogen to fuel the rest of your crop rotation. And to get a good handle on where that is in your soil and whether or not you need to take some action of either sourcing livestock manure or doing some grazing is critical.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us, Catherine. We're really happy to hear your thoughts and get some of the insight that you've gained from talking to all the farmers that you talk to on a regular basis. So,
well, thanks for having me, and I really enjoyed talking about this, and I've, you know, been really privileged to talk to a lot of the farmers across the prairies that are doing some pretty great things. So I'm very happy to share some of the information that I've gained from doing that.
Check out the Pivot website at www.pivotandgrow.com. It has tons of resources to help you through each step of your farming journey, from transition to production, marketing, and research. You can also follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook at Pivot and Grow, or join in the conversation using the hashtag Pivot and Grow.